This Weekend starts right after this.
When you run a small business, even the smallest decisions are stressful. But there's one that's easy. The decision to make your business better by switching to Vonage's award-winning cloud-based communication service. With seamless mobility between your devices so your employees can connect with your customers while on the go. Call 1-800-5-VONAGE or go to Vonage.com to make the switch now. Call 1-800-5-VONAGE or sign up at Vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This Weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
The effects of solitary confinement. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend here. Coming up this hour, what would it be like to spend 10 years in prison isolation? We'll examine Texas inmates who had trouble adjusting once they were freed, including issues with vertigo. Also, today's American family, stressed, tired, and rushed. We'll examine why and whether potential relief is in store. Plus, the perfect excuse to stay inside and watch football in the weeks ahead instead of doing yard work on your weekends. And how some ski resorts are making the sport even more expensive.
Launching fancy restaurants, amped up kids programs, new terrain parks, heated lifts, all sorts of kind of bells and whistles to attract people to the mountain and also to, you know, to get them to spend more while they're there.
Wall Street Journal reporter Andrea Peterson on elevating ski vacations from economy to first class. She's here in about 20 minutes. Fascinating story from USA Today, which has been tracking nine Texas inmates for 13 years now, all of whom spent prolonged periods in solitary confinement. They were released in November 2002 from isolation on the same day and have all returned at least once, and some of them have returned multiple times. It's this confinement that's recently drawn the scrutiny of the Justice Department and some lawmakers. USA Today reporter Kevin Johnson has the story. He's on the T-Mobile hotline. Kevin, what have you found?
I think there's an understanding out there that you just have to be a really serious offender to be in there. And that is the case in many instances. But in a lot of cases, prison systems around the country have routinely dealt with gang members or people who've been associated with gang members by assigning them to solitary confinement to keep order in the prisons. That's been the case in California for a long time. It is the case in Texas still. So your mere association with a criminal gang would land you in solitary confinement, often for the duration of your term.
My goodness. And what do the experts say solitary confinement does to a human being?
Well, I guess more than the experts, I guess, is what actual offenders report when they leave, or okay, what you can observe after they leave. I've spoken to a few of them, and a lot of them report having difficulty, just basic difficulty, making the transition back to a place that's larger than an 8x10 cell. There's one fellow who left after a long period, years in solitary, and described a kind of vertigo, for lack of a better word, in which he found it difficult to maintain his balance in a large place. Talked about going to a Walmart or a Kmart and walking into the place and immediately having this feeling that he may lose his balance, so he would walk in those places with his back against the wall just to find some steadiness. And things like that are often reported by these folks. They tend to seek, even after their release, seek places where they can be alone because that's where they're most used to being or have been for many years.
We're speaking with Kevin Johnson, reporter at USA Today. He's got a fascinating look at solitary confinement and how after more than a decade after the release, all of these folks that he's been tracking have gone back to prison. All right, so what do you say to the cynic who says, well, you know what, they're prisoners, so they did something pretty bad to get in there in the first place, and if they were dumb enough to join a gang and get sent to solitary, I have no sympathy.
Sure, that's a common, you know, refrain, and you hear it a lot. But if you carry that out a little bit further, all of these folks, or most all of them, are going to get out eventually. And so what are the consequences then? That has a bearing on society and them personally. So you either deal with them now or you're going to be dealing with them later.
And no windows in all of these cells or most of them, some of them?
Very few, if any. In the row where this gentleman that we talked to, his cell has no windows. He had recently been moved to a wing where he has now a partial view of a door in the distance where he can tell whether it's day or night. But usually that is, folks can only determine or make that determination by looking at a clock. So there's very little natural light or any view to the outside.
All right, so the guys who then are released from prison after spending time in solitary confinement and then return are committing offenses that automatically send them back to solitary, or are they actually earning their way back in once they get sent back to prison? What's happening there?
Well, often, their association with gangs or other groups that landed them in solitary follow them for their careers. So if they're released and on the outside commit another crime, in this guy's case, picked up 3 DUIs about 5 months. At the same time, though, when he was sent back, he was not sent into a treatment program. He was sent back to solitary confinement because of his past association with the Mexican mafia.
It's really something. USA Today reporter Kevin Johnson. You imagine going into a big box store and having to walk with your back against the wall because you're afraid you'll lose your balance? It's 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
He's in the paint, down by 2. Can he do it? The ball is up. It's nothing but net. The crowd goes wild.
Hey, Greg, waiting on your PC again.
Yep. Want a front row seat to the big game?
No, I'm good.
A workplace that doesn't work is anything but beautiful. Give your employees the power to do their best work and reduce downtime by 50% with new, powerfully performing Dell and Intel technology. Learn more at dell.com/business.
Here's a story that might require a look in the mirror. As you have probably noticed, kids are much more likely than not to grow up in a household in which their parents work these days, and in many cases, both parents work full-time. That's much different from the old days. That's made things increasingly difficult to balance. Working parents say they feel stressed, tired, rushed, and short on quality time with their children, friends, partners, or hobbies. More from New York Times reporter Claire Kane Miller. Claire, take us through this.
Well, it's really no surprise to people that most children are raised in families now where the parents work. Either they are raised by a single parent, and most often it's a she and she works, or both parents work outside the home. It's a really big change from previous decades, but it doesn't appear to be going back. The number of stay-at-home mothers, the share of them is really declining. And the result is that there are a lot of working families that are just completely stressed because the workplace and the cultural norms around modern family life have not really caught up with the fact that parents are so much more likely to work outside the home today.
Right. Boy, how did we wind up in this spot where, say, one salary wasn't enough anymore?
Well, a lot of things happened. First of all, women began to be educated and be able to work in ways they weren't before, and it turned out that they wanted to. So a lot of women are choosing to work outside the home. And then in a lot of places in America, as you referred to, it can be harder to get by to be a middle-class family on just one salary than it used to be. Obviously, if both parents work, the family earns a lot more. And so there's this situation where that's very common, but then otherwise, we still look a lot like we did in the 1950s, where workplaces really aren't very amenable to people having parental duties outside of the workplace because they were sort of built for a time when husbands worked and they had stay-at-home wives. And public policy really hasn't caught up either.
Interesting. All right, so you alluded to it before, where it seems in some cases we haven't adjusted to a norm in which both parents work. What would that, I guess, full adjustment look like? I guess we're doing it in some ways by allowing people to work from home, perhaps, the telecommuters?
That's right. That's a big one. Some people say that it could be changes in the workplace, like allowing telecommuting, allowing people, I interviewed one family where the husband works four 10-hour days, and then he has Fridays off to spend with his baby. You know, those sort of flexible schedules, people say would make a lot of difference. Another thing would be at the governmental policy level, things like paid family leave, so that when parents had a new baby, they could take some time off to spend with them. Another thing a lot of social scientists I talked to and families mentioned would be after-school child care. School still ends, you know, at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and no one's workday ends then. So it can be really difficult if there's no one at home.
Right. Wow. We're speaking with Claire Kane Miller, staff writer for The Upshot at The New York Times. Her piece is called Stressed, Tired, Rushed, A Portrait of the Modern Family. Anybody predicting that we might go back to the old days where it was simpler and just one spouse worked, whether it was the man or the woman?
The researchers that I've talked to said it really does not look like that's happening. The share of parents who are working just keeps rising, and now it's almost 70% of mothers with children at home work outside the home at least part-time. Nobody really sees us going back to a time in family life where it's extremely common to always have one parent staying home.
Yeah. What kind of stress do some of these families go through? I know we go through it in my house sometimes.
Well, of course. I mean, they described feeling very tired. 80% of parents with a job describe feeling rushed all the time or most of the time, meaning, you know, as you, I'm sure you can relate, you're just living your life thinking, you know, I'm rushing from one thing to the next. One of the most striking findings to me here was that those parents who said it was difficult to balance work and family were also more likely to say that they found parenthood to be rewarding and enjoyable less often. So,
wow.
You know, that really shows that this is starting to affect family life and the way that parents interact with their children.
Right. Well, what do you do? I mean, if we're not going back to a simpler life, do we as today's adults have to learn to, I don't know, better manage stress? Is that where we are?
Well, there's a big debate about whether this is a personal problem in which each family just needs to figure it out. So that might mean better managing stress. That might mean, you know, every Sunday night dividing out the chores for the week between the two of you. You know, whatever it is, it helps your family get through it. And obviously, people need to do those things. But then there's a lot of social scientists who say it shouldn't just be an individual problem, that maybe workplaces should change and be more understanding, you know, that as long as you get your work done, we understand if you might have to leave at 3 o'clock for a pediatrician if you're going to sign back on at 8 p.m. A lot of workplaces just don't have that flexibility, or they expect a lot of face time and long hours. And public policy, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, the United States is the only industrialized country that has no paid family leave whatsoever for sick family members or for new babies.
Thanks, Claire. New York Times reporter Claire Kane Miller. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Good news if you have a lot of money and take part in expensive hobbies. The skiing industry just found ways for you to spend more of your hard-earned cash. Wall Street Journal reporter Andrea Peterson says ski resorts are focusing their efforts on the affluent travelers who are making up a bigger chunk of their audience. Andrea, what's trending?
Ski resorts are giving people more options to sort of ski kind of in the economy section of the mountain or first class. I mean, it's sort of this, what we've seen in hotels and airlines for a long time is actually coming to the ski mountain. So there's all these new pampering services that you can pay for, including Vail Resorts, which is one of a big operator at West, is opening the White Carpet Club at its Beaver Creek Resort in Colorado. And it's basically a private club that you can join by the day or the week. So for $150 a day for up to four guests, the club will offer a private lounge with complimentary coffee, tea, cocoa, and snacks, personal lockers, and help from concierges with things like restaurant reservations.
All right, so this may not all be necessary, though, but if for the fact that we're not skiing as much as we used to, right? The industry is kind of in a struggle.
Well, the industry, it's the visitation to U.S. ski resorts is pretty much plateaued in over the last 10 years. But what's more concerning to ski resorts is that the participation by kids under the age of 18 is dipping, and those, you know, are their future paying guests. So that is something that's really causing people consternation. Also, people are skiing fewer days.
Yeah.
So they're not as active. So, I mean, and also there's a lot of competition from various ski resorts, and so they've been doing things to try to get people to spend more money when they're on the mountain. And that includes things, you know, launching fancy restaurants, amped up kids programs, new terrain parks, heated lifts, all sorts of kind of bells and whistles to attract people to the mountain and also to, you know, to get them to spend more while they're there.
Mm.
A lot of resorts are also offering for a fee something called that they call First Tracks, and that is where you actually can start skiing, you know, an hour and a half before the mountain opens to the general public. And, you know, I talked to one guy who has done this a couple times. He says it's absolutely amazing. You can, you know, there's no lift lines. There's, you know, pretty much nobody on the mountain.
Yeah.
And you can get in a ton of skiing before, you know, before the rest of the crowd show up. So that's another way you can kind of ski first class.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Andrea Peterson. Her piece is called New Ways to Ski First Class. You know, I skied when I was younger, and I can remember if I had that hour and a half before the place opened, you might actually ski more during that hour and a half than the whole rest of the day by
right.
the time the crowd showed up, just because those lift
right.
lines can be so long, right?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It might be worth it.
And what's interesting is that some interesting data from the National Ski Areas Association has shown is that skiers are becoming more affluent. About 58% of ski resort visitors during last year's season lived in households making more than $100,000 a year, and that was up from about 45% in that same income bracket during the 2006-2007 season. So ski resorts are definitely, you know, that's another reason why they're rolling out more services that will appeal to this affluent skier, because those are the people that are showing up at the mountain.
All right, so give us another example of a resort that's doing something fancy.
Okay. Well, this is also at one of Vail's other resorts, the North Star California Resort in California. There's something called, they've just launched last year, the Primo Private Lesson, which includes a full day with a private ski instructor. And you get private ski fittings in your room, your hotel room, or your condo, wherever you're staying. And concierge help. Telluride Ski Resort in Colorado is launching this VIP concierge program that is going to include all sorts of special tours, such as a jaunt on the mountain with local residents. You'll be able to get lunch reservations at their All Rids restaurant, which was previously reserved only for members of their ski and golf club.
It's Andrea, Wall Street Journal reporter Andrea Peterson, who's based in New York. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, having the difficult conversation with elderly relatives about Alzheimer's. There's got to be a better way to mail and ship stuff. Going to the post office takes up too much time. Forget about leasing a postage meter. It's way too expensive. Turns out there is a better way. Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your desk using your own computer and printer. You can even get special postage discounts you can't find at the post office. Plus, Stamps.com is more powerful than a postage meter at just a fraction of the cost. Did you know that you can save at least 50% compared to a postage meter? And you'll avoid those time-consuming trips to the post office. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deal. That's Stamps.com and enter Deal. November is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. The sad fact, more Americans are living with it with each passing year. Alzheimer's and family caregiving expert Stephanie Erickson is here to talk about having the conversation with elderly relatives about future care. Stephanie, what can we do?
Everyone should prepare and be proactive in planning for aging. That's not to say that everyone will have Alzheimer's disease, but it certainly needs to be part of the conversation among families as we're planning on the aging process.
The numbers for Alzheimer's are just going to continue to grow, right? Because we have so many baby boomers now turning 65.
That's exactly right, and medical advances are fantastic. So people are living longer. The longer we live, we have more risk of getting dementia. Right now, we're looking at about 5.1 million Americans right now that have Alzheimer's disease, and it will double by 2050.
Wow. All right, so Is there a way, say, to give a 1 year snapshot of what happened, say, last year during Alzheimer's Awareness Month to this year? Have we made progress on, say, different management types or a cure?
Unfortunately, no. There is always different research that's being done to look for a cure, to look for a cause. Unfortunately, we're not that much closer to that point where it's pretty stagnant in terms of development.
Yeah. All right. So in terms of now having what always will be a difficult conversation with, say, elderly relatives, how do you do it?
I think the first thing is just to try and get to know your elderly relative unrelated to anything between you and them. So, for example, you're going to want to find out about their relationship with their own parents because it gives you an idea of how they see the aging process and how the young take care of the old. You'll want to ask them questions about how their parents aged and what kind of care and support they provided. And then I think you can start to introduce recent events that you found in the media or a movie that you've seen to understand how your relative processes different things related to aging, crises, and how they would want someone to support them. And then finally, once those connections are made, you can get more into the nitty-gritty in terms of how you particularly can support them.
Mm. We're speaking with Stephanie Erickson, Alzheimer's and family caregiving expert. We're talking about this being Alzheimer's Awareness Month. There was a startling bulletin here that I want you to explain a little more about. Alzheimer's is the only major cause of death to have a positive growth change from 2000 to 2010, with an increase in death rates of 68%, meaning what exactly?
It means that the number of cases of people that are dying with Alzheimer's rate is increasing at that rate as compared to something like heart disease, where the deaths related to heart disease are going down. It is very scary, but that tells you what is happening in terms of our awareness and our knowledge of how to prevent the progression and eventual death from this disease as related to other things like heart disease.
Right, right. All right, so does it get the attention and awareness that it deserves in your mind? Are pharmaceutical companies doing what they can? Research is doing what they can.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is some attention. It's not completely under the radar, but if you compare it to other movements or other disease groups, let's take, for example, breast cancer. I mean, those advocate groups have done a tremendous job with raising awareness and funds for that particular disease. I mean, even last year we had the ALS Bucket Challenge, so a lot of people who had never heard of ALS, this huge movement was created in a very good awareness campaign. We don't really have that for this disease area, and really once November comes and goes, it's kind of like it disappears.
Thanks, Stephanie. That is Stephanie Erickson, Alzheimer's and family caregiving expert. It's 21 minutes before the hour on this weekend. Are you working in a toxic office environment? Could be one of the reasons you're not happy at your job, right? Dr. Paul White is a psychologist and author of a book called Rising Above a Toxic Workplace. Maybe some stuff you should consider before you go back to the office on Monday. He's got some signs you should be looking for. Paul, help us out.
Toxic workplaces basically make you feel like you're being poisoned and you're dying slowly. And they involve bad communication, which starts out as either no communication or distortion, lying, indirect communication, people going around the person they should talk to. Highly negative workplace, people are complaining, grumbling, lots of sarcasm, cynicism. That's a problem. Toxic leaders, and they don't have to be at the top of the organization. They can be, you know, midway down, supervisors of departments or whatever. But basically, they're all about themselves, and they only look out for themselves. So they take credit for work that other people do. Mm. They are sort of Teflon-coated. They don't let anything bad stick to them. They use people. They manipulate information. It's not an incompetent person. These people are bad dudes and ladies that just are out for themselves. And, I mean, probably one of the biggest sort of signs is just that you feel like you're not healthy.
It can take time, though, right, as an employee to recognize a toxic workplace, right? Sometimes
absolutely.
You just might think it's you that needs to adjust or something.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in fact, one of the things about a toxic workplace is your thinking gets sort of fogged and screwed up, where you start to take on responsibility for things that really aren't yours, and you feel like it is you, and if you just do better or do it differently, and often your colleagues or boss will tell you that it's you. But in actuality, I mean, over time, you may be able to see, or somebody else will can tell you, it's like, dude, this is not you. This is just a nasty place, and they're taking advantage of you. And if you don't set some boundaries, you're going down.
We're speaking with Dr. Paul Weitz. He's a psychologist and also author of a book called Rising Above a Toxic Workplace. You can also see more at his website, appreciateatwork.com. And we're talking about signs you're stuck in a toxic workplace. How about the negative communication that you talk about?
It's huge. There's just a lot of negativity out there. And one of the things, though, that is important to me is we're not just victims. I mean, I'm not here to sort of let people whine and complain, well, what a bad place I work at. We all have choices we can make, and one of them is to not, you know, contribute to the negativity. If you got a group of friends, you walk up and they're grumbling and complaining, just say, hey, I'll catch you guys later. And so don't engage in the negativity. And then secondly, we know that when you start to make some positive comments about people that are doing stuff right, that can grow.
Generally speaking, the toxicity that we see in workplaces comes from where? Is it poor managers?
Basically found that there's sort of three major parts. One, there's a sick system. There's a lot of just sort of chaos, really. I mean, it's the kind of place where you call one day and you get an answer to a question. The next day you get a totally different answer. Sick systems, secondly, are toxic leaders, people that are just out for themselves, taking advantage of other people. And basically, they sort of kill people emotionally around them. They may get stuff done, but there's a revolving door because nobody can stand to work with them. And then third part is dysfunctional colleagues. And, yeah, we're all dysfunctional. We can sort of blame each other. But bottom line is people that just consistently blame, make excuses, don't take responsibility, skate, you know, out of things. And also they're really good at sort of what I would call a let's see you and him fight. You know, they sort of get other people set up to fight.
Thanks, Paul. Dr. Paul Weitz, psychologist. The book is called Rising Above a Toxic Workplace. He's also got a website called appreciationatwork.com. It's 13 minutes before the hour on This Weekend.
You're a small to mid-sized business with 300 to 3,000 employees. You face the same network security challenges as big businesses do, but can't support a big IT investment, leaving your doors open to advanced cyber threats. Barracuda Next Generation Firewalls provide all the core features of enterprise firewalls and UTMs, but without hidden costs and deployment hurdles, making owning a big business firewall no big deal for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Next Gen Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/firewalls.
Are the political postings on Facebook starting to exhaust and frustrate you? Stephen Pretlow, columnist at USA Today, says with a year to go before we elect a new president, it's already starting to look like a nasty beat-em-up free-for-all on his social media feeds, especially Facebook with all the politics. He's got some thoughts on how to manage the nastiness. Stephen, help us out.
What's happening on social media is driving people crazy, and it's driving family and friends apart because you know, it's as though we've lost the ability to have conversations and civil discourse with each other. So a lot of name-calling. I think, Gordon, you've probably seen some of the memes that, you know, are both sometimes funny but often, you know, very mean and pointed and don't really facilitate political conversation, which is what I and many people think. That's what this country is based on, regardless of, you know, your political color.
Yeah. I often use the phrase, are you advancing the conversation, right? Or are you just name-calling and being nasty? I think that just wears most people out.
And you know, and it's a particular problem of the way, quote-unquote, conversations have moved online. You know, I think all of us know and remember that, you know, at the holidays, or when you're with family, you know, you can't talk to people face-to-face the way we do online. We even see that in the debates. You know, oftentimes the candidates will say one thing about their competitors, and then, you know, they're standing on a podium, you know, inches away from that person. You know, they can't look them in the eye and be as rude.
Right.
So, you know, definitely part of the problem is the medium, in that we feel that we can just say anything that we want, and part of that, you know, unfortunately, is true because if I disagree with you, Gordon, I may just choose to, you know, to unfollow you, which means I won't see your post,
right,
or, you know, or unfriend you, and then, you know, I'm not going to be exposed to any other ideas. And, you know, I don't think that's a good thing either. We need to talk to each other. We need to learn from each other.
We're speaking with Stephen Pretlow, columnist at USA Today. He's got a piece entitled, How to Handle Your Friend's Facebook Posts When It Comes to Politics. I know we're sort of wandering out of bounds with this as I make this next statement, but you know, as a columnist, the anonymity of it all, of the postings, really adds to it, really adds fuel to the fire, because then people just feel like they can say anything and there's no accountability. That bothers me. I understand freedom of speech, but hiding behind the anonymity, I can't stand.
You know, I completely agree, and as a columnist, I get a lot of emails, you know, and a lot of people don't like what I write, and they do hide behind, behind being anonymous, and, you know, it's a lot easier to really let it rip when you're that way.
All right, so kind of get to the heart of it here. What do you do when you see some stuff that you don't like, you disagree with, or is just nasty? I mean, how do you manage that?
Well, there are a couple of strategies that I point out, which is that when each of us is posting, you know, think twice and post about things, you know, post facts, post figures. When you're getting into the funny, you know, think again, is everyone going to think this is funny, or is someone going to think this is mean or pointed? Second, if a friend or a colleague or a relative has posted something that you disagree with, don't attack them personally. Never make it personal.
Thanks, Stephen. Stephen Pretlow, columnist at USA Today. 6 minutes now before the hour on this weekend. This is an important time of year for football fans, right? The NFL season is about halfway done. College football teams are jockeying for a spot in the top bowls. But sometimes your weekends have to be dedicated to housework. That's not convenient with football on both Saturday and Sunday. But the National Wildlife Federation is providing football fans, rather, an out, at least when it comes to raking leaves. The group says don't rake them, because they can benefit your lawn, your garden, and wildlife. A blog post says the leaf layer is like its own ecosystem. One critter that depends on such a leaf layer is the chipmunk. And if you're raking up your leaves, you're also raking up butterfly and moth nests. The post also mentions that leaves make a great natural mulch and help suppress weeds. But if you do insist on keeping your yard cleaned up, the NWF recommends doing it the old-fashioned way, because leaf blowers pollute the air. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. I'm Gordon Deal.
When you run a small business, even the smallest decisions are stressful. But there's one that's easy. The decision to make your business better by switching to Vonage's award-winning cloud-based communication service. With seamless mobility between your devices, so your employees can connect with your customers while on the go. Call 1-800-5-VONAGE or go to Vonage.com to make the switch now. Call 1-800-5-VONAGE or sign up at Vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.